Hello and welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service at the end of another grim week, with Hurricane Maria, the fourth hurricane to beat Category 3 this season, mercilessly battering the Caribbean, and in Mexico, still recovering from one powerful earthquake. There's a second. I'm Roland Peace, and we do have positive news in this programme with a major step forward in the use of gene editing.
The other aspect is critical insights and knowledge about which genes might be responsible for why pregnancies fail.
And some sound, solid science from the Stone Age caverns of Europe.
It's fascinating to think that our ancestors' activity might have somehow been mediated by their appreciation of sound.
But we start with the seismic events in Mexico. The powerful, shattering 8.1 event 2 weeks ago was notable enough in its own right. And then on Tuesday, after a lapse of just 11 days, the second. Less powerful, but more deadly, because it struck closer to major population centres like Mexico City. Mexico is, of course, on the Pacific Rim, and so, like Chile and Japan, is prone to violent shaking when slabs of seafloor grind tectonically underneath the overlying continental crust. 8.1 would be the kind of magnitude you could expect when that happens, and an aftershock of 7.1 could also be anticipated, but seismologist Stephen Hicks says neither of these earthquakes fit that pattern.
We call this tectonic plate that's sinking the Cocos Plate, and that's really sinking below and grinding against the upper plate, the North American plate. So that collision and the strain that builds up because of that is really what can cause some of the typical magnitude 8 plus earthquakes that occur in that region of Mexico.
And is that what happened now twice in the past couple of weeks?
No, actually, so the last two earthquakes we've had in Mexico over the last 10 or 11 days, they've been related to this overall tectonic process of subduction, but very different to the shallow types of earthquakes that occur offshore or along the coastline. So these two earthquakes both occurred within the subducting Cocos Plate itself. So it's within the lower plate. So it's not colliding there with the upper plate. It begins to bend and it bends under its own weight. And that can start to almost pull apart this plate that's sinking. As the plate goes deeper into the earth, it actually bends more gradually. And that really does, on the top of the plate, it causes cracks to pull apart or existing fractures to pull apart, causing extensional or normal faulting type earthquakes.
So this is a kind of a great big crack almost that appears within that sinking bit of seafloor. How big in each case was that crack and how quickly did it develop?
It's possible that the crack's actually there already before the plate sinks. As it begins to bend into the deep ocean trench that we call the Middle America Trench, that bend in there begins to open up some of these cracks. And then as the plate descends further to 50 kilometres plus, we then enter a regime where the weight of that plate becomes the dominant force, which then starts to pull apart those cracks. And these cracks might, you know, we can image them around the trench region itself. We can see them in maps of the ocean floor. And they might extend for hundreds of kilometres in the direction of the coastline.
And these two quakes so close together, it's sort of pretty natural for me to think that one caused the other.
It's a very good question, and it's a question that a lot of people are asking. So we can look at the magnitude 8.1 earthquake that occurred 10 days ago, and we can start to think, well, what was the amount of stress that this earthquake could have exerted on the fault that ruptured in the 7.1 earthquake? Now, the two earthquakes occurred about 600 kilometres apart, and we wouldn't really expect there to be a significant amount of stress applied to the fault that the 7.1 occurred on. Probably, if anything, it's a very tiny amount. And so we can then surmise that the fault that ruptured during the 7.1 earthquake must have been close to rupture in any way. Perhaps the 8.1 pushed over the edge very slightly, but more work will need to be done, more calculations will need to be done, and data collection over the next few months to see if this hypothesis is true.
So it could be that a 7.1 earthquake may happen at some place in the Earth. The fact that they were within the same country was just one of those awful coincidences.
Yeah, so earthquakes continue to surprise us seismologists. The Earth is so complex, the geology is so complex, particularly tens of kilometres deep into the Earth where we can't clearly image the different rock types. This complexity really is something we can't accurately simulate right now in our computational models.
So for people, the physics of what's going on 50 kilometres down isn't so important. It's actually the shaking that's going on at the surface. Given that these were quite different strength earthquakes, what does that mean in terms of A, the shaking locally, and B, the shaking in the major population centres like Mexico City?
So often we characterise earthquakes by their magnitude. The actual magnitude type is called a moment magnitude, and these are the values of 7.1 or 8.1 that we see quoted. Now, magnitude relates to the amount of energy at the earthquake source itself. So it doesn't tell you anything about the impact of the seismic waves on the surface. So obviously for a larger magnitude, you get a greater amount of seismic energy released. But then it also depends on how far that earthquake is from a population center at the surface, such as Mexico City. So the 8.1 occurred, you know, 600, 700 kilometers away from Mexico City. Therefore, the impact of the seismic shake wasn't as great. Whereas the 7.1 earthquake that occurred yesterday was located only about 100 kilometers to the southwest of Mexico City. So we saw much greater shaking intensity at the surface. Plus, it was a shallower earthquake, 50 kilometers versus the 70 kilometers of the 8.1 earthquake. And Mexico City itself, the geology there is very interesting. The city is built on an ancient lake bed, so it's an actual lake thousands of years ago. Now it's just full of the sediments or the soils that were deposited at the bottom of the lake. And this thick layer of soils really amplifies or exaggerates the amount of seismic shaking when seismic waves enter this region. And it's also, it's a basin, so it's surrounded by valley sides. So when seismic waves enter this area, they reverberate around, they bounce around the edges of the basin. The increase in seismic shaking intensity can also be accompanied by an increase in the amount of time that the shaking occurs for. So you can have prolonged shaking at a very high intensity in places like Mexico City.
Stephen Hicks from the University of Southampton. Now, I hope that in 2 weeks' time, we will be celebrating the award of a Nobel Prize to the scientist who invented the gene editing technique, CRISPR. Developed just a few years ago, it's taken biology by storm. And a few weeks ago, we reported on the team who believe they've cracked the problem of making the technique reliable enough to correct genetic errors in human embryos. Much anticipated have been results from the UK's Crick Institute, where Kathy Neacon has a licence to use CRISPR to study the role of specific genes, which are key to an embryo's survival in its first few days. In these days, the fertilised egg subdivides first into two cells, then four, and so on, until there are around 200 in a hollowed-out ball called the blastocyst, which can implant in a normal pregnancy. Inside it, there are just 20 cells destined to become the fully formed human. So the genetic choreography coordinating these cells lays the basis for everything that follows. And the gene for a protein called OCT4 looked critical to deciding how that embryonic foundation gets established.
The vast majority of the cells in that developing blastocyst are the progenitor cells of what will become the yolk sac and the placenta.
The life support system.
Precisely. And so those cells, 180 or so out of the 200 cells, are the critical cells that nourish and support the continued development of the embryo itself. But what we don't understand is how do you set aside those 20 out of the 200 cells? What are the key ingredients that you need to set those cells aside?
And that's where this OCT4 protein comes in.
Precisely. So OCT4, we know from the work of model organisms like the mouse and established stem cells, that it has an important role in the development of those 20 embryo-fated cells. But what we didn't know is whether it had the same role in the human context or not. And what we found that was really surprising is that it not only has this important role in setting aside those 20 embryo-fated cells, but also in the placental progenitor cells, which is a bit unexpected because that's in some ways different to other contexts.
And this discovery comes about because you've been a gene vandal.
Well, we've used genome editing techniques, in this case the CRISPR-Cas9 mediated genome editing. And what that's enabled us to do is to precisely inactivate OCT4.
You trashed it.
Well, we stopped its function, in effect, in order to gain insights, critical knowledge about what it does. And that's how we understand how genes work.
So you go in at the very earliest stage of the fertilized egg, and some of them you use this gene editing to trash the gene, and in others you let it develop normally.
Precisely. And what we found is that when we compare the embryos in which OCT4 has been inactivated, that it demonstrates a critical role for OCT4 in the development of the human blastocyst within this first 7-day window. And the importance of that is that we know in, for example, in IVF clinical context, most IVF embryos don't reach the blastocyst stage for reasons that are unclear. And of the embryos that do look based on their shape to resemble a blastocyst, most of those don't implant. And again, we don't understand why. And so now we have a tool to look at the function of genes, the role of genes, that allows an embryo to develop to these stages and allows them to continue to develop successfully.
And when you say the blastocyst didn't develop, is it that the whole embryo just died off, or was it that things went wrong with the way it grew?
Well, that's an important question, and I think we're still at the point where we'd like to further understand the effect and the critical role of OCT4, and that will require a lot more research. So what our data suggests is that you need OCT4 to even initiate the blastocyst. In embryos where you have partial OCT4 protein, they do try to make a blastocyst, but they can't be maintained. And so I think that that shows that there maybe is this really important, more essential role for OCT4, and I think our research is aimed at better understanding its role in the future.
You've talked about this one particular protein called OCT4. I imagine it's not the only one that's at play at this point. Are there other genes that within this first 7 days that you're going to look at next?
We've identified a few other genes that we think also have important roles, like similar to OCT4. And we're interested in those genes because we also predict that they may have important functions in stem cells and how those cells are set aside during the establishment of stem cells. What fascinates us is what is that molecular hierarchy, so to speak? Not only is what's the function of OCT4, but then what in turn does OCT4 regulate, and what does that in turn regulate downstream of that? And so we want to really unravel all of these different intricate mechanisms. The knowledge that we gain about the function and role of genes underpins further developments in the future. So those developments may be, for example, improving stem cell treatments and stem cell biology. It could also mean improvements in fertility or IVF treatment, because we still don't know why IVF embryos don't reach this blastocyst stage. And now we've shown that there's an importance for OCT4 in that. Maybe there are other genes that we can study. The other aspect that in the far future might hopefully be gained from this is critical insights and knowledge about which genes might be responsible for why pregnancies fail. So this tool enables us to gain that critical information.
Dr. Kathy Nearcon of the Crick Institute in London, and her report on the work appeared this week in the journal Nature. Links on our webpage at bbcworldservice.com, along with links to our podcast library of past editions of Science in Action. Now, I said I'd been waiting for that study to become public, and beside me are Caroline Steele, Bobby Lakira and Sam Oon, who've been waiting to deliver some of the other of this week's science stories. First, Bobby, some conservation good news.
It is good news indeed. I've got a new study of the world's 7 sea turtle species, and it's showing that their numbers are on the up, which
now,
is great.
Now, they were being threatened, I think, by fishing and by beach invasions.
Yeah, being caught up in fishing nets, and eggs and adult sea turtles kind of being taken away or harvested as well. So the consistent decrease in numbers, that prompted concerns, as it obviously should have. Since the 1950s, though, worldwide conservation efforts, so like strict fishing regulations and the beach protection you mentioned, and also marine protection areas being set up, they've halted this decline and numbers are back up.
Now,
you know, I say good news in conservation. I suspect that nothing's unsolid. Is this all species and everywhere?
Well, despite this good news, as we've trailed it, six species, they do remain endangered, unfortunately. So there is still work to be done to protect them. The Hawaiian green turtle, that is doing the best. But other species like the hawksbill, loggerheads, leatherbacks as well in the eastern and western Pacific, still in trouble.
But it does show that these efforts work.
They do, they do. It's been decades of work, but all those measures put in place have really had an impact.
That's excellent. Caroline, you've got a flash in the sky.
Yes, I do have a flash in the sky in the form of cosmic rays.
These are charged particles that have come from, well, outer space, somewhere in outer space.
Yeah, exactly. They're not rays, they're particles, which are really, really high energy, and they bombard our atmosphere from outer space. And they were first detected over 100 years ago.
But there's been this question, I think, about the really high energy ones. So I was reading, I don't know, 20 years ago about there are some which are so high energy they don't know how they were made, how they got here.
Yes, exactly. And they're so rare that they're really hard to study. So only one arrives at the Earth's surface per square kilometre per year. So they're super rare and super hard to study.
So either you need a lot of years or a lot of square kilometres to actually detect them.
Or both, in the case of the Pierre Auger Observatory, which have been studying them for over 10 years now. Their results show that these super high energy particles originate from outside our own galaxy.
Now, that's really interesting, because I know that I was seeing papers which were suggesting that they become so energetic because they're sort of whipped around by magnetic fields, perhaps in our galaxy, but they didn't know where those magnetic fields would be.
Yes, exactly. But it turns out that these haven't been generated in our own galaxy because of the distribution, the direction that they come from, doesn't match that of lower energy particles. So we know these ones must come from elsewhere. So they must come from outside our own galaxy.
I mean, it's extraordinary. It must mean that there are rare things great distances from us.
Great distances
from us.
And
these are flying through intergalactic space for millions of years.
Yeah, well, some of them are flying for billions of years. They're coming from so, so far away, and they were made so long ago. But hopefully, looking at these particles, we can learn a little bit more about what's going on outside our own galaxy.
So like those black hole mergers and things, there's just amazing physics yet to be discovered.
So much yet to be discovered, yeah.
OK, now, from that to Sam, some news about snoozing.
Absolutely. So some scientists in Caltech have studied the Cassiopeia jellyfish, which is also known as the upside-down jellyfish. And that's kind of because it spends most of its life on the ocean floor upside down, which is, which is a nice life to have.
Well, being upside down is one thing, but how do you know if a jellyfish is asleep?
So what they did was they had to prove three criteria. And the first is that they had to show that it had a period of reduced activity. And they did this by...
I've never seen a lot of activity in jellyfish anyway.
I know. So they looked at these jellyfish for 24 hours of the day. And they find that at night, they pulse 39 times per minute, which is less than their usual 58 times per minute during the day. And this
just
shows...
Just taking it easy.
Just taking it easy. And what they showed next was that they also had a slower response during this time. So when they put these jellyfish on a higher platform in the tank and waited until they fell asleep, they pulled out the platform underneath them and they counted the number of seconds that it took for these jellyfish to move back down to the bottom of this ocean floor. And it took them longer when they were in the sleep state than if they were awake. And finally, they also had to show that these jellyfish were sleep deprived. And what they did was they kept poking these jellyfish pretty much for the whole of the night. And when they did this, they found that they were more likely to fall asleep during the day.
Yeah, so they're obviously chillaxing during the day. But why is this? Why were they looking for the information about the jellyfish?
Who cares about sleeping jellyfish?
They feel as well like the jellyfish are quite like humans, I figure.
That's right. So they did this because it shows that jellyfish, which are the most ancient evolutionary animal that we know of, do sleep. And this suggests that sleep is this ancient evolutionary behavior that has lasted through thousands of years of evolution.
And the thought just keeps you awake, actually, nevertheless. Sam, Bobby, Caroline, thanks very much. Music, too, seems to have come down evolution, human evolution. Rock music, let's call it. Even our Stone Age caveman ancestors like to settle down and chillax to a bit of music, it seems. In fact, despite their Neanderthal image, they were quite cultured, as the art you find on cave walls also reveals. The suggestion has been that they used cave paintings to mark out the places where the acoustics are best. Well, for archaeoacoustician Bruno Fazenda of Salford University, this link was charming but not proven. So he packed up his kit and headed off to the caves of Altamira in northern Spain to sound out the truth and see what sense he could make of the strange ancient markings.
So one of the caves that we visited in the north of Spain, one of these dots on the ceiling of one of the caves is assumed to be over 40,000 years old, and the most recent activity dates to about 15,000 years ago. So we call them motifs because that term encompasses all sorts of paintings, engravings, whether they're dots or some more refined drawings. The earlier type of motifs were these dots and simple lines, and then they progress through hand stencils and then into the animal shapes.
So what's your concern, firstly, that some of these motifs, the acoustic effects weren't really well defined, so that it might be a little bit stronger or something of an echo, but not much stronger? Or was it that there were places where you got a strong effect where there weren't any motifs? I mean, these are statistical questions, I guess.
I think it's fascinating to think that our ancestors' activity might have somehow been mediated by their appreciation of sound. Now, as a scientist, my approach is to try and collect the evidence for a given hypothesis. And when we went into the caves, we went in with a defined strategy of measuring at both positions where there are motifs and positions where they're not. And of course, then analyze whether we've got significant statistical evidence to support the idea that the motifs are basically in places with what we'd call striking acoustics.
I mean, I would imagine that if I went into one of these caves, it would be sort of echoey everywhere, and you need to find something more important, more significant above that.
So most people tend to believe that caves are, let's call them reverberant, which is the kind of effect that you get when you go into a church or a cathedral. One of the striking results from our newly published research is that the caves that we visited weren't particularly reverberant, as in the highest reverberation time that we measured in these caves was just a little bit over 3 seconds. Now, some cathedrals will very easily exhibit reverberation at, say, 7 seconds, 10 seconds.
But what sort of sounds were you using? Was it the equivalent of a clap to measure the qualities of these spaces?
What we've used was the state-of-the-art standard method for acoustic measurements, and it's basically composed of a sweep, so a single frequency that sweeps from very low frequencies all the way up to the very high frequencies at a certain rate. That's the best method to extract the response of the space to an impulse like a clap. But if we were to use a clap, we run into a lot of methodological problems. One of them is that it's not repeatable. I can clap 2 times and the sound that comes out is not exactly the same. Secondly, the clap doesn't excite all frequencies equally. And thirdly, it doesn't have enough amplitude for us to get a good signal-to-noise ratio for our measurements. So the sine sweep, through a mathematical transformation, allows us to extract the impulse response in the best conditions possible. And so it's the standard measurement used for, say, measuring concert halls, small rooms, even equipment.
So in the case where you got the most convincing connection between the sound and a spot, what was the sort of the sound or acoustic property that stood out?
The original claims that were made in the late 80s were that whenever there is a resonance, you will find a dot within a radius of 2 meters. A resonance is typically what you hear when you sing in the shower.
One of the things I find when I sing in the bathroom is there might be a particular note that suddenly booms compared to all the others.
When you hear that effect, you know you're in the presence of a resonance. Now, when we looked at the results of our study, there is an association between earlier motifs and resonances. When we looked at all of the motifs, whether they're the earlier type, dots or lines, or later type, the animals, we found that there is an association between the position of the motifs and reverberation. But in this case, they were more likely to be found in places of moderate reverberation rather than large reverberation, as it has been claimed in the past.
I think the cave dwellers, like us, are allowed to change fashion over 15, 20,000 years. So what they'd like to do might change. But overall, you went into this skeptically. Do you think there is something in that original claim about cave motifs and sound quality?
We are not rejecting the original hypothesis. I do, however, have to make this interpretation quite carefully, because when we've got a statistical correlation or association, we don't necessarily have causation. And what we need to consider is what would be the other possible explanations.
You've done some of these tests, I think, in caves in Spain and other parts of Europe. How widespread do you think this could be? Do you think if you go to caves in completely different parts of the world, you'll find similar kinds of correlations, which would then be more interesting?
Now, of course, the question of whether other caves around the world might exhibit the same sort of behaviour is really interesting. We'd love to now visit other caves in Indonesia and Africa and, you know, in the Middle East to try and find out if other cultures were somehow behaving in the way that we might be trying to find here.
Cave music with the Ring of Truth. Thanks to Bruno Fazenda, ready to pack his bags and find resonances around the world. That's what I call a job. Mine now is to wind things up here on Science in Action. If you've liked what you've heard, there's an archive of past programmes on our webpage at bbcworldservice.com, plus links for more on everything in today's edition. The producers today were Caroline Steele and Jack Meegan. I'm Roland Pease. And next week, I'll be joining the crowds at the New Scientist Live Festival in London to talk conservation.